KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
And he said, I'll tell you something. I think most directors do their best work early. He said, I think I did my best work early. He said, I think The Graduate was my best film.
Director Douglas McGrath's new HBO documentary, Becoming Mike Nichols, charts the rise of the legendary director of hits on stage and screen. The film covers two interviews with the then 82-year-old Nichols, one of only 12 people in the world to win Tony, Emmy, Grammy, and Oscar, the last for his second film, The Graduate. But first on the News Banter, a major shakeup at ABC, and Deadpool shakes up the superhero universe. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So let's start with television, a shakeup at a broadcast network. It's almost like, you know, the inevitable thing that is going to happen at every single broadcast network, especially now. Things are so difficult in the broadcast business. You know, having said that, there's still billions of dollars in advertising being sold. Broadcast is still the big tent. But at ABC this past week, ABC Entertainment Group President Paul Lee, a British gentleman who had overseen a pretty good run until this past year, out, and a woman named Channing Dungey in.
Yeah, and you know, not only is she the first African-American female to run a broadcast network, she's the first Black person to run a broadcast network. Mm. I think it's interesting in two ways. First of all, it shows that Ben Sherwood, who runs all of the ABC Disney television properties, is really making his mark here for the first big move that he's done under his new job. And he's elevating a person who has a very strong relationship with Shonda Rhimes, the most important talent at ABC. So you're seeing the importance of talent there. Also, it shows that Ben Sherwood and Paul Lee did not really get along. Paul Lee, who had had some success over his tenure, this season has sort of been a disaster for the network. The Muppets reboot is just not working. A lot of the Marvel shows that Disney really has a priority on, they're not working. You know, it's tough for Paul Lee because they don't have sports on ABC to help launch shows and to boost, you know, ratings whenever football is on, like NBC has. But they're just not getting those breakout shows that they need other than Shonda Rhimes shows,
right,
which is now the Shonda Whisperer in charge of the network.
Right, because Channing Dungey ran drama for ABC, and obviously Shonda Rhimes has Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder. She's the most important talent at ABC and one of the most important talents at any network. So yes, that relationship is critical. I feel like, you know, Ben Sherwood comes from news and a lot of the old guard broadcast people, it's sort of polarizing. There are some people who think that Paul Lee wasn't working and Ben Sherwood, fine, he's promoting a veteran who can get things done and enact his will. And there are other people who are saying, well, Paul Lee had done a good job and one bad season shouldn't cost him this much. So it'll be sort of interesting to see how Ben Sherwood plays in the industry. You know, sometimes the tribe turns on somebody if they perceive them as an outsider.
That's true. I mean, remember Jeff Zucker at NBC when he was running all of NBC Universal, and he came from news like Ben Sherwood, and he installed Ben Silverman at NBC, and that was a disaster. So we'll see how this works out.
He installed Ben Silverman, it was just an unmitigated disaster. It was one of the most remarkable continued ascents in the history of broadcast television. I used to say that Jeff Zucker's career at NBC proved that the laws of gravity are really only guidelines because he just kept getting promoted until he was let go. So we'll see if Ben Sherwood does better. I hate to even burden him by linking him with Jeff Zucker because that was so bad. But I think some people do feel that if you're an outsider and you didn't grow up in the broadcast TV scripted programming business, they don't necessarily root for you.
True. But, you know, the other side of that, you know, Ben Sherwood is a new person in this job. You know, you got to give him a chance. You got to see what he's going to do. And the ABC network is an area for improvement. And he's doing his best
he's
to
doing
put
what he can. We'll see.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Fox, you know, they had such a disaster last summer with Fantastic Four, which just did not work on any level. You know, they still have some Marvel properties, the X-Men franchise, even though Disney now owns Marvel. That's a pre-existing deal. They came roaring back with Deadpool, which is just an outsized hit. It did $152.2 million over the President's Day holiday and is still going. And it's a different kind of superhero movie. It's an R-rated superhero movie. It brings Ryan Reynolds back from somewhere where he's been for a long time. And it's just been a phenomenon that has people almost evaluating whether the whole superhero trend is now taking a turn.
Yeah, that's the interesting question out of this is that you saw Fox take a deliberate turn from what has worked in the superhero genre for the past 10 years almost, which is these big, broad, four quadrant, they call them. Everybody can go.
PG-13. Bring grandma,
yeah, PG-13. Bring grandma, bring the kids. And, you know, they're very kind of blandish, you know, mass entertainments. And this was a movie that, you know, on paper at least, was a one quadrant movie. It is a young men movie. It is not for older audiences. It's not for women. And it turns out.
Oh, watch out. They'll come down on you, Matt.
No. I'm saying when it turns out when you do something out of the box and when you do something interesting and the key word is different, you not only hit that target audience, you bring in everybody else who is curious to see what's going on. It does change the game here.
Yeah, I wonder if Marvel is looking at, should we darken? And of course, the one that already is dark, but maybe not necessarily in the same humorous kind of way, because what the element that seems to be sort of part of the secret sauce here is a little bit of a wink and a little bit of humor about the whole thing is Warner Brothers with their DC Comics universe. They have a very important movie. They've had a dreadful year, and they have Batman versus Superman coming out in March. A lot writing on it because this is supposed to launch the DC Comics universe. They don't have a guy like Disney has in Kevin Feige who has really known how to guide the Marvel universe there. It's hard to replicate a Kevin Feige. So, you know, so many eyes now on how is Batman versus Superman going to fare in terms of what it tells us about superhero movies and specifically about Warner Brothers.
Yeah, and I think actually, if I'm at Warner Brothers, I'm a little concerned. And Deadpool is actually making me a little bit concerned because now, you know, if Batman Superman doesn't get to this $150 million opening weekend, it's not a failure, but it's not as big as the one-off movie that Fox made for 60-something million dollars and all of a sudden has this gigantic, you know, hugely profitable movie. Warner's movies are more expensive. These DC movies cost a lot. They have a very serious tone to them. Zack Snyder, who's kind of in charge of the look and feel of these movies, there's a danger here that this Batman Superman movie looks like an old-time version of a comic book movie when people have now moved past that to a Deadpool-style comic book movie. I could be completely wrong. It could do huge business and be amazing, but does feel like comic book movies have kind of turned the page now with what Fox did with Deadpool.
So we'll see. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. When 7-year-old Mikhail Igor Peshkowski arrived in America in 1939, fleeing Nazi Germany, he knew only one English phrase.
I don't speak English. Please don't kiss me.
Eventually, that child not only learned English, but became a master of the language, an award-winning comedian, director, and producer. The new HBO documentary, Becoming Mike Nichols, covers two interviews with the director, the last he would ever record. Of course, Nichols recalls his early collaboration with fellow comedian Elaine May. Nichols and May were famous for sketches developed through improv, including a Grammy-winning album in 1960.
know that I had my hand
Arthur,
on the phone.
Arthur, you were supposed to call me last Friday.
Mother, darling, I just didn't have a second, and
you
I could
didn't
cut
have
my
a
throat.
Second.
I was so busy.
Arthur, I sat by that phone all day Friday.
It was just work, work, work. And
all
darling,
day Friday night.
I kept thinking, I got to call Mom.
All day Saturday.
Oh, listen, believe
and all
me.
All day Sunday. I, and oh, your father felt, said to me, Phyllis, eat something, you'll faint.
Darling.
I said, no, Harry, no. I don't want my mouth to be full when my son called me.
Mom.
Becoming Mike Nichols covers its subject's transition to directing on Broadway, Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park, and The Odd Couple, before moving on to his first film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. The 1966 movie was nominated for 13 Oscars, including for leads Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
Until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all, that maybe Georgie Boy didn't have the stuff. Maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will.
Nichols won an Oscar for directing his second film, The Graduate.
Put on music, now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me.
Our guest today, Douglas McGrath, is the director of the Nichols documentary and himself a multifaceted talent. He's a writer, actor, and director. He co-wrote the script for Woody Allen's Bullets Over Broadway. He directed Emma, based on the novel by Jane Austen, and you may have seen him on screen in HBO's Girls. McGrath's involvement in becoming Mike Nichols came through New York Magazine columnist Frank Rich, who's an executive producer on the film.
I was in my office one day. The phone rang. I knew Frank just a little from life here in New York, and he called and he said, you know, would you be interested by any chance in making a documentary about Mike Nichols? And really, it took only as long as it took for me to part my lips to say yes, because I've always been interested in Mike. And the way that the idea itself came about was that Mike had had a deal with Knopf to write his autobiography. He had tried to do it for a long time and for whatever reason, just couldn't do it. I don't know if it was that he was too busy or if he couldn't quite figure out how to tell the story, but it went away. And when it went away, his friend Jack O'Brien, who's a celebrated theater director, when Jack heard that Mike wasn't going to write the book, he thought, oh, this is a big loss for everybody because Mike has so many wonderful stories.
Right.
And so Jack told this to Alex Witchell, who is Frank's wife. And she said to Frank, you know what Jack just told me? And immediately the sort of the idea came about, well, then if he's not going to do the book, what about a documentary? And HBO was all over it right away because they had done with Mike two great things. Mike had done Wit for them and he had done Angels in America for them. And he was about to do a new film for them of Terrence McNally's Masterclass. And they loved him. You know, they really admired him and loved him. So Richard Plepler, who's the head of HBO, said right away, just whatever you need, let's do it. And I had done a documentary for HBO about Jerry Weintraub called His Way. And
right.
We had a very happy experience doing that. So they suggested me to Frank, and Frank thought, great. So that's how it happened.
Now, so let's talk about it for what it is for a second. You have two separate interviews that were done with Mike Nichols, one with an audience, one without. And you intercut so that sometimes it appears that the question has been asked in both settings.
Mm-hmm. That's true. We originally did 3 days of filming. We ended up not using the third day for a variety of reasons that once I kind of decided that the film looked like it was going to be what it is, we didn't need the things from the third day.
Meaning that it stops with The Graduate, basically.
That's right. That's... After we got into the editing room, it became clear that the area that Mike had the greatest enthusiasm for were the early years, was that early period with his career starting with Elaine, with the early work on Broadway, and with his first two films. And one day he told me on the phone when we were chatting, I said, here's what I'm thinking of as the shape of the film. It would be about you becoming Mike Nichols, about you learning all the things you needed to learn, exploring both improvisational comedy, directing for the stage, and directing your first two films. What do you think about that? That way we don't have to race through it just to touch on Postcards from the Edge or Working Girl or any of the other wonderful things that came after. And he was very enthusiastic about the idea. He loved it. He said, oh, I think it's much better because then we can really explore the stuff I'm talking about. And he said, I'll tell you something. I think most directors do their best work early. He said, I think I did my best work early. He said, I think the Graduate was my best film. And in the movie, as you know, he says that he thinks that his direction of The Odd Couple, he thought The Odd Couple was the best thing possibly he ever did on Broadway. So it kind of fit with his thinking about his career.
Mm-hmm. Did you shoot the same questions twice? Because there are times where he's literally wearing one outfit and then it cuts and there's nobody in the audience. And then the next minute he's wearing a different outfit and there's a full audience.
A couple of times over the 2 days. So the first day was no audience. It was just Jack and Mike on stage at the Golden Theater where Mike and Elaine had done their show all those years before. And they were talking about a lot of things that we felt made sense not to have an audience present for. More personal things, more, you could almost say, more intellectual and theoretical things. But occasionally, things would come out, as he talked about Elaine, for instance, and he would tell a funny story about her. And then somehow the next night, when the audience was there, he was reminded of that story, and he just told it again. And so when we had two versions of it, it wasn't calculated to have two versions. But once we had two versions, I thought, you know, it's kind of great to show both versions, to cut back and forth between them, because there's a kind of dynamic quality when you cut between the two rather than the standard version of just sitting, having the camera sit there as he tells the story.
Mm-hmm. I see. So at that point, where was he in terms of his health?
Well, I knew nothing about his health, meaning he wasn't talking about it. He didn't discuss it in any way. And to be honest, I don't know what the issues were. He was 83. He had lived a full life.
I must say he looked well.
Well, you know, one of the things we noticed in all the footage of Mike, meaning the documentary footage, by which I principally mean the still photographs of him, what was both interesting and poignant in hindsight was that in almost every picture he was holding a cigarette or a cigar.
Right.
And I do know later, we didn't talk about it, but I learned later that I think he had emphysema or some kind of, you know, serious breathing issues through the years. But he died, as I understand it, this is what I understand, but I'm not
right.
Speaking for the family or anything else. I'm just saying, I think what happened was he didn't die of any particular illness. He had had his pacemaker, I think, adjusted that day and was home and was comfortable and then stood up, boom, I think had a heart attack and went. So I don't think it was the result of a long and lingering illness. And I do know that he was planning to go after our film was, you know, in the middle of pre-production for Masterclass.
So you alluded to the research. Some of this stuff, I mean, very extended material primarily from The Graduate. And that can oftentimes be a sticky wicket. I don't know whether you were given special consideration because, you know, it was a blessed mm-hmm. project and whether Simon and Garfunkel had to, you know, I don't even know who controlled the rights to that music at this point.
I don't either. We could call the HBO lawyers. They'll know. I do know people who were asked for approvals were generous in giving them because of their long affection for Mike. But I do want to say something about the film clips in the movie. In a documentary, you know, in anything where you're using film clips are like carpet. You know, you pay by the yard. And the wonderful thing about HBO is that money was never an issue in that respect.
That's HBO.
And I know, and it's so wonderful because then what can happen is if Mike is going to take the time to explain it, then you can show the full scene so the audience can feel what he's talking about. You know, usually you get 15 seconds or 20 seconds, and if you haven't seen the movie, you just think, well, that's Dustin Hoffman, I guess, or, oh, that's Richard Burton. But here we run the whole Bergen monologue from Virginia Woolf. We run this whole sequence where you see Burton discover this thing and then eventually cry. And my hope is that by running enough of it, the audience, if they haven't seen the film, will feel enough by watching the scene that it'll make them want to see the films.
So where were you in terms of the production when Mike Nichols actually died?
We were in the middle of post-production. I was in the middle of cutting the film. I was getting close to a first cut, to a rough cut. And it was, I tell you, it was such a shock. It was such a shock. I'd just spoken to him the week before. He sounded great, cheerful, as usual, sharp as a tack. It's that thing you just never know. The thread that holds each of us here, sometimes it just gets snapped like that. So, you know, it's that cliche, but, you know, it just tells you you have to not wait to call the person you think you'll always have there to call. You just have to cherish and enjoy every second you get with someone.
Coming up after a short break, McGrath talks about a lesson he learned from Mike Nichols that he applies to his own career. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and filmmaker Douglas McGrath, who directed the new HBO documentary, Becoming Mike Nichols. The film features extensive photographs and clips from Nichols' career, as well as his last recorded interviews, in which he shared insights he acquired as a Tony and Oscar-winning director.
There are only three kinds of scenes: negotiations, seductions, and fights. I'm finished. That's all. All scenes come into one of those three categories. How often have you rehearsed a scene for 2 weeks and then said, oh my God, it's a fight? And you can do the same with seductions and most of all with negotiations, because that's mostly what we do in life.
McGrath's documentary includes interviews with Nichols shot just 4 months before Nichols died at 83 in November 2014.
It was that thing where you think, well, all of a sudden, you know, from that day, when he died forward, you think, well, this really is the last extended document of Mike on film. It acquired a different importance, but it didn't change what the film itself was.
I wonder if when you came into it, you know, you're a film director yourself, you felt like, I want to go to Mike Nichols and figure out whether he has the secret sauce that might be helpful to me, or whether you thought, eh, I already did Emma, I've got this.
Well, no, I didn't think that. I always think, what can I learn here? And I'm always interested. I've been lucky through the years to meet and know some really incredibly gifted and also articulate artists. The joy for me was that sometimes from my office during editing, I would just call him and chat. And he was always so generous and helpful. And he almost never said anything that you couldn't really write down and print and pass out to people. You know, he was an extremely epigrammatic and articulate person.
Well, there's a story in there where he's going to direct Virginia Woolf, and I think Jack Warner had issues. He didn't want it to be in black and white. And Mike Nichols tells the story that he threatened to walk out, and that this was when he learned how to have power in Hollywood, I guess, right? Mm-hmm, it's just to be willing to pack up and go home. And I don't know, did you say, yeah, I do that?
Well, it's so not my nature, but believe it or not, I paid a lot of attention to that story. It's a great lesson for all filmmakers, because Mike knew when to make a deal and then when to take his stand. He knew what was essential. And in the case of Virginia Woolf, to make that movie in color was to make not the right movie. Part of what is great about Virginia Woolf is that it's in black and white, which makes it an entirely different experience for the audience.
It's more like a distancing from, this is not life, this is a statement about life.
Yes. And Mike, in fact, talks about how he feels one of the great losses in modern filmmaking is when we essentially gave up black and white and only made films in color, because he felt that black and white was itself a metaphor. So when you see a film in black and white, you know that whether it's realistically shot and realistically written and acted, it's still not life. It's a distillation of life, and you can experience it in a different way.
I thought it was a funny thing in the with one of my favorite little moments in the film is when he says that his cinematographer came to him in the middle of this argument about with Jack Warner and said, well, if you really want the effect that you're looking for, you shoot it in color and show it in black and white. And Mike Nichols is like, okay, you're fired, because he saw this as a ploy to give Jack Warner what he really wanted. And I thought, boy, he got that really quick. That's the way he's telling this story.
There are many qualities of Mike's to be mentioned, but almost the first one you have to mention is how smart he was. I have this belief that could be, of course, like many of my beliefs, completely wrong, but this is my belief, which is that when Mike came over to America, he came, as you know, as a refugee from Nazi Germany. But then he got here, and you know, if you're a kid, you do not want to stand out. Kids do not want to be different from other kids. And so what he had to do was to study what made the other kids like the other kids and what made American kids different from German kids. And what, you know, he had to learn very quickly how to make distinct observations between people. And I think what it did was it honed a very acute sense of the particular in him. So it really developed his smarts. And I think it gave him a sense not only of physical and personality differences in people, but I think he became very alert to psychological qualities in people, which he used to his great benefit in that exact story you're telling.
Okay, so your career, you've written stage musical, beautiful, the Carole King musical, directed Emma. You wrote the screenplay for Bullets Over Broadway.
With Woody,
and,
yes.
Okay, and you act. So how do
I don't
you
really
decide?
Act.
Well, you've got a lot of credits here. I'll just say that.
No, that's true. I do. I seem to have a lot of credits. I don't know how this happened. But everything I've been in as an actor or as a poseur, which is what I prefer to think of myself as, has always been at the invitation of a friend of mine who's directing. So sometimes I've been in Woody's films. I've actually ended up quite hilariously doing 4 episodes of Girls because I knew Lena a little bit. And I always accept because I want to see how these people – I want to see how they run their sets because I'm always curious for myself as a director. I think, what do they know? Let me see. Let me study. And it's kind of – I think one of the joys of my career is that because I do a few different things, I never feel like I'm in a rut. I love writing and I love being at my desk in the quiet of my office. And then after a while you think, is there anybody else out there? So that when you direct, you know, it's a lot of fun. I'm a social person. And then after a while you're like, when are these people going to go home? I like it where it's nice and quiet in my office. So, you know, I have a nice balance between those things.
Right, right. And it's been a while since you've done a feature film. Is it just kind of like, what? Why?
Well, when I worked on Beautiful, the Carole King musical, you know, a Broadway musical, I had no idea, to be honest, but it's like it's like invading Europe. It's a really big thing. So Beautiful was a big chunk of my life. And it was a very joyful chunk because I got to work with Carol and Jerry Goffin and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, who were fantastic people. But now it's up. It seems to be having a happy and successful life. And so this year I'm going back to work on a feature film with my friend Christine Vachon.
A recent guest on this show.
Oh.
With Todd Haynes.
Oh, yeah, of course. Christine and I made a film together called Infamous, and I had an absolutely great time with her. And so we're going to do it again.
You're going to do it again. So you also write satire pieces, one of which absolutely made me laugh out loud recently. This one about Donald Trump, which is funny. I commend it to our listeners. And you just do that like on your downtime when you're not making musicals and writing Woody Allen scripts and making documentaries and whatever else.
Well, I'll tell you this. One of the nice things about being a writer, my very first job in show business was as a writer at Saturday Night Live. In what I think can safely be described as the worst year in the show's history. And I made a significant...
Not because of you, I assume. Credit for that?
Well, I think I made quite a contribution to the lowering of the standard that year. But, you know, part of your job was Weekend Update. And it got me thinking in a satirical way from an early age. I was 22. And I've always been fascinated by politics. And through the years, I've written about politics satirically, but hadn't done it for a long time. And then this year, Trump comes into the GOP, into the primaries. And you watch him and you're just like, what? I think I am safe in saying no one who wants to be elected has ever said the things he has said. So I thought, why is he doing that? You know, part of your job when you write, even if you're adapting something like Emma, you have to always think about your character's motivations, what makes them pull out the gun or kiss the guy or, you know, whatever it is. So I'm always looking at people in real life thinking, why are you doing that? And so the piece I wrote for The New Yorker about Trump was the only possible explanation I could come up with for why he is saying the things he's saying.
Douglas McGrath is the director of Becoming Mike Nichols. Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
A link to Douglas McGrath's satirical take on Donald Trump is available on our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness. Becoming Mike Nichols premieres February 22nd on HBO. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from Mario Diaz and Kat Yore. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.